It's time for Native Sun, a program bringing you Indigenous news on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Today we'll be hearing stories from The Circle, as well as other publications, such as the New York Times. The first story is NCAI condemns Trump's push to reinstate racist team names. No author was given from The Circle. The National Congress of American Indians, NCAI, is condemning Trump's efforts to pressure the Washington Commanders and the Cleveland Guardians into reverting to names and mascots widely denounced as offensive to Native Americans, a campaign tied to a high-stakes stadium deal in the nation's capital. In a statement issued in July 21, 2025, the NCAI criticized Trump's public threat to block a new stadium deal for the Washington Commanders unless the team restores its former name, the Redskins, a term Indigenous groups have long considered a racial slur. Trump also called for the Cleveland Guardians to revert to their previous name, the Cleveland Indians. Any attempt to distract by invoking our names and purporting to speak for our communities is an affront to tribal sovereignty and is not taken lightly, said NCAI President Mark Macaro. For 75 years, NCAI has held an unbroken voice, imagery and fan behaviors that mock, demean, and dehumanize Native people have no place in modern society. Recent reports indicate that Commanders co-owners Josh Harris and David Blitzer are privately considering Trump's demands, driven by concern that Trump could derail their plans for a new stadium on the site of the old Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Stadium in Washington, D.C. The deal, approved in an initial vote by the D.C. Council on August 1st, involves more than $1 billion in public funds and over $1 billion in tax incentives. While the team has publicly reaffirmed its commitment to the commander's name, internal discussions suggest apprehension over Trump's influence, who could use his appointment powers, particularly over agencies like the National Capital Planning Commission, to delay or block necessary federal approvals for the RFK Stadium site, which is on federally leased land. The stadium site transfer from the National Park Service to the District of Columbia was finalized in December 2024, but the deal remains contingent on several layers of federal oversight. A final vote on the stadium deal by the D.C. Council is expected in September. NCAI's statement warned that allowing political interference to dictate team branding would set a dangerous precedent. Conditioning federal policy or development deals on the revival of racist language contradicts the government's responsibility to uphold tribal rights and dignity, threatens the integrity of lawful governance, and opens the door to future discriminatory policy demands, the organization stated. The Washington franchise dropped the Redskins name and related imagery in 2020, following decades of protest from Native American leaders, civil rights organizations, and fans. The team temporarily became the Washington Football Team for two seasons before adopting the name Commanders in 2022. The Cleveland Guardians similarly retired their former name and mascot in 2021. At that time, NCAI praised both teams. In 2020, it commended Washington for eliminating a brand that disrespected, demeaned, and stereotyped all Native people. In 2021, it celebrated Cleveland's move as an important step forward in healing the harms its former mascot long caused Native people, in particular, Native youth. Our youth deserve to see themselves treated with dignity, not punchlines or cartoonish relics of the past, said NCAI Executive Director Larry Wright Jr., referring to a related decision earlier this year by the U.S. Department of Education. The continued defense of these mascots is a refusal to confront racism. Enough is enough. Trump, in contrast, has claimed Native American support for reinstating the old team names in public remarks. He asserted that our great Indian people in massive numbers want this to happen. But NCAI firmly rejected that claim. Indian country has repeatedly come together to condemn the unsanctioned use of harmful Native-themed mascots, particularly those which sexualize, stereotype, or dehumanize American Indian and Alaskan Native people, the statement read. NCAI, established in 1944, is the nation's oldest and largest organization representing tribal governments. Since 1950, one of its core priorities has been the eradication of racist and stereotypical portrayals of Native peoples in sports and popular culture. Our position and that of Indian Country, broadly rooted in unanimously passed resolutions reflecting the perspective of hundreds of tribal nations, has not changed, the group stated. With the future of the RFK Stadium project hanging in the balance, NCAI is urging team owners and political leaders to remain steadfast in upholding the dignity and humanity of Indigenous communities. We are not your mascots, the statement concluded. We are not your distraction. Next, tribal stations at risk as Trump defunds CPB. From The Circle. No author was provided. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB, a cornerstone of public media in the United States since 1967, will cease operations after Congress rescinded a $1.1 billion in previously approved funding. The announcement comes in the wake of a major appropriations bill passed by the U.S. Senate that excluded any future allocations for the nonprofit and just days after Trump signed into law a rescissions packet. Despite the extraordinary efforts of millions of Americans who called, wrote, and petitioned Congress to preserve federal funding for CBB, we now face the difficult reality of losing our operations, Patricia Harrison, CPB's president and CEO, said in a statement. The shutdown is expected to take full effect at the end of the current fiscal year, September 30, 2025. Most CPB staff will be laid off at that time, with a small transition team remaining through January 2026. Founded under the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, CPB has long provided federal support to National Public Radio, NPR, and the Public Broadcasting Service, PBS, and more than 1,500 local stations across the nation, including dozens of tribal and rural outlets. These stations often serve as vital information hubs for underserved communities, particularly where broadband or cell coverage is scarce. The funding loss is expected to deal a particularly devastating blow to Native American communities, where tribal-run stations rely heavily on CPB dollars to operate. According to Native Public Media, an organization that advocates for Indigenous broadcasters, dozens of Native stations now face the threat of closure. These are not just radio stations. They're lifelines, the group said in a statement. For many rural Native communities, these are the only sources of local news, public safety alerts, emergency messaging, election information, and cultural programming, which include language preservation efforts. In areas without reliable internet or cellular service, radio remains a crucial means of communication. For some tribal communities, shutting down local public stations could mean the loss of access to weather warnings, wildfire alerts, missing persons bulletins, and critical health updates. Sean Patty Murray, Democrat, Washington, the top Democrat on the Senate Appropriations Committee, voiced strong opposition to the decision to strip CPB from the Labor, Health and Human Services and Education spending bill for fiscal year 2026. It is a shameful reality, and now communities across the country will suffer the consequences as over 1,500 stations lose critical funding, Murray said during a committee markup session. In July, the Republican-led push to defund the CBP voted to pass a $9 billion rescissions package that clawed back federal spending on public broadcasting and foreign aid, including the $1.1 billion earmarked for CPB. Trump signed the bill days later. The elimination of CPB is being hailed by Trump allies as a victory for what they describe as efforts to drain the swamp and reduce federal overreach. For Native broadcasters, however, the consequences could be existential. Many stations operate on shoestring budgets, relying on CPB funding not only to keep transmitters running, but also to produce culturally relevant content, much of which is unavailable elsewhere. Some stations broadcast in Indigenous languages, making them rare and valuable tools in the effort to preserve endangered tongues. Others provide unique community forums that blend traditional knowledge with modern public health and civic engagement content. Though discussions have emerged about potentially shifting tribal media funding to other federal departments, such as the Department of the Interior, Native Public Media warned such proposals may be structurally impractical and unlikely to fully replace CPB's role. Moreover, the ripple effect extends beyond the tribal communities. Public media operates as a cooperative ecosystem, with member stations contributing dues and content to national networks like NPR and PBS. The collapse of dozens of native and rural stations could weaken that system, reducing resources for high-quality journalism, children's programming, and emergency broadcasting across the country. In a July report, Native Public Media concluded that the loss of CBB support threatens to silence important voices in the Native American community and could exacerbate existing challenges in terms of access to information, emergency services, and cultural preservation. It's not just about keeping a station on the air, the one station manager from the Northern Plains who asked not to be named for fear of layoffs. It's about keeping a community connected, informed, and alive. Next up, Music Camp Sparks Creativity and Friendship for Native Youth by Chanda Colvin from The Circle. The sounds of drums, guitars, and singing resonated throughout the Lower Sioux Indian Community's Recreation Center located in southern Minnesota. 10 Indigenous youth formed their own bands, learned instruments, and composed original songs at the Rock the Res, a week-long music camp for Indigenous girls, Two-Spirit, and gender-diverse youth ages 8 to 17. The summer marks the first year the music camp is in Minnesota. Co-founder and coordinator Maureen Mo O'Brien says the camp aims to empower youth through music. Rock the Res started in 2016 on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, where O'Brien was a teacher at the time. It was born out of the want for accessibility to music and the accessibility for this kind of expression and art, she said, noting the lack of representation of Indigenous women, Two-Spirit, and gender-diverse individuals within the music scene. We really wanted to concentrate on uplifting girls, Two-Spirit, LGBTQ+ youth, and really embrace their identity. And then also in that, we were creating allies who know how to be allies, who know how to speak up for their friends, who identify that way, said Executive Director April Mattson. Campers are not required to know an instrument to participate. Starting from day one, volunteers and staff help them to learn the basics of instruments, such as guitar, bass drums, keyboards, and vocals. Shasha Gregg signed up for the camp after some reluctance and encouragement from family. The 16-year-old had never played drums before Rock the Res, so they spent the week learning alongside their band, Da Pound. "I didn't want to do it at first because I'm quite shy," Shasha said. "I don't regret it, though. It's fun." Their bandmate, 12-year-old Melina Robinette, says the camp helped her to learn the value of friendship. She met Shasha for the first time earlier in the week, but as the two sat together on the floor of the practice room, drafting and drawing a logo for their band, one might think they've been friends for years. "A lot of people here just accept each other, and they're not mean about the other people making mistakes or other stuff," Melina said. While Rock the Res has a focus on music, it also offers workshops throughout the week, like making dream catchers, medicine pouches, or zines. Mattson says the added activities provide a way for learning how to create and put that creativity into the world. "One of our camp values is mistakes are cool, and we say, you're going to make mistakes. You have to make mistakes to learn something new," Mattson said. "It's really fun and exciting, and we're all making mistakes together." The workshop also provided an opportunity for youth to get connected to members within their tribal community. You're listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. One community volunteer is Stevie Pendleton. Pendleton has been playing the guitar for over 2 decades, a passion they say has opened many doors and outlets of creativity for them, including being able to teach guitar at the camp. Likewise, they said having opportunities like Rock the Res not only helps youth, but those all across the community. "It helps all of us to blossom our creativity, to get out of our shells a lot more and kind of have more community and connection, and gives us a way to express ourselves and talk and feel more validated as well," said Pendleton. "Sometimes you don't always get that, either at home or even in your own community school." The expansion of Rock the Res came after Indigenous community leaders in Minnesota reached out to the program. Before this year, the music camp was only held in South Dakota. "It's just exciting to be bringing it other places. But with every new thing, every change comes a little bit of fear, a little bit of uncertainty," says O'Brien. Despite this, the camp at Lower Sioux Indian Community was filled with laughter and music. In the second band, 10-year-old Theda Weiss says she became more comfortable with singing throughout the week. During practice, Veda showed no signs of shyness as she held onto the microphone and sang a song about the feeling of summertime. I liked camp because I got to meet like other people I didn't know, and the counselors are really nice to me, she said. Rock the Res has two more sessions in Minnesota before the end of summer, in Minneapolis, August 4 through 8, and Bemidji, August 11 through 16. Up next, sawing down Borneo's rainforest to build RVs for Americans, by Wee Soo Lee from the New York Times. Word spread fast that heavy machinery had arrived in the ancient rainforest near the Indonesian village of Sungai Mata Mata, an expanse on the western edge of the island of Borneo that is home to orangutans, clouded leopards, and sun bears. Flouting the law, the excavators began digging trenches to drain the area's protected wetlands. Then came the logging crews, which cut down woodlands the size of more than 2,800 football fields in just a few days. It was an apocalyptic sight, says Sam Siddar, a regional forestry official who goes by one name, recalling the devastation he encountered 2 years ago. The trees had turned into piles of wood. Not just any kind of wood, though. The trees were meranti, a species found mostly in Indonesia and other parts of Southeast Asia, and their tropical hardwood is of particular interest to one industry in the United States, manufacturers of motor homes. The United States is the world's largest producer of recreational vehicles and has relied for decades on meranti, which is also known as luan. The timber is processed into a plywood that is lightweight, moisture-resistant, flexible, and cut into thin sheets. RV makers use it for interior walls, flooring, cabinets, and other features. Catering to this demand, conservation groups say, has accelerated deforestation in Borneo. In the last 5 years alone, tens of thousands of acres of the island's forests have been chopped down for luan, usually with the Indonesian government's permission. This has contributed to the disappearance of some of the world's largest rainforests and wetlands, unleashing dense stores of carbon, upending the lives of indigenous people, and endangering the habitats of orangutans and other animals. Since 2020, the United States has bought more than $900 million of the luan plywood that goes into RVs, the vast majority of it from Indonesia, U.S. trade data shows. Luan is also used by the construction industry. The American RV industry has long portrayed itself as a good steward of the environment. It calls on its consumers to protect public lands and promotes its vehicles as a way for people to connect with the great outdoors. Among the big RV makers, Thor Industries says its suppliers are forbidden by U.S. law to buy illegal timber, and Winnebago says it is committed to preserving the planet. Thor added that it was not aware of any deforested wood in its supply chain. Winnebago referred questions about the origins of its luan to its supplier, Patrick Industries, an American company, and the RV Industry Association, neither of which responded to requests for comment, nor did Forest River, another big RV maker. But the industry has defended its use of luan, some of which is selectively harvested so forests can continue to grow. Without access to luan, manufacturers would be forced to use thicker, heavier material that reduce livable space, impact fuel efficiency, and compromise the structural design and safety of the RV, the RV Industry Association said in a letter to the Trump administration in April while arguing against new tariffs on the plywood. In short, it added, luan is not just a preference. It is a functional necessity integral to nearly every RV built in the United States. Some composite materials have emerged as potential alternatives to luan, but RV makers say they are not as versatile and are typically more expensive. Conservation groups say RV makers are only focused on price and do not have policies to responsibly source luan. This allows deforested timber to taint the industry's supply chain, they say. Sustainability-grown luan now is plentiful in Indonesia, and while it goes for about 20% more, Earthsight, a group based in Britain, argued that outfitting an RV with only that kind of wood would have a negligible effect on its price. Nature-loving RV owners would surely be more than happy to pay this tiny price, said Sam Lawson, Earthsight's director. Thor and Winnebago did not comment on Earthsight's assertion. Forest River did not respond to a request for comment. Indonesia has long seen its forests as an economic resource and has cleared tens of millions of acres of forest this century alone, much of it for palm oil and pulpwood. But the American RV industry's role in deforestation has drawn little scrutiny, a driver of deforestation. Demand for RVs in the United States soared to a record during the pandemic, and now more than 8 million American households have one. Anna Montgomery, a landscape architect in Charleston, South Carolina, bought one for her family of four in 2020. Her 20-foot Winnebago Mini Winnie cost $77,000. Ms. Montgomery said she had spent years researching the vehicles, dropping in on RV shows and dealerships to look at materials, but she did not know her vehicle may have deforested timber. It wasn't anything I had thought about, Ms. Montgomery said of her RV purchase. Here I am thinking I got a good RV, but what is the reality of it? Last year, around tens of thousands of trees were felled in Indonesia to supply the construction of RVs in America, according to EarthSight. All of those trees were from rainforest, and most of the logging was approved by the authorities. Several conservation groups have concluded that the RV industry is now the biggest use of tropical plywood in the United States. United States, EarthSight, and Indonesia-based Auriga Nusantara shared government documents and shipping records showing how deforested wood travels from the Indonesian rainforest to American RV makers. It is unclear whether the RV industry was aware of the origins of the wood. Barbara Kuiper, a supply chain expert at Profundo, a Dutch nonprofit, also reviewed EarthSight's findings. The RV industry stands out, she said, for its role in overall U.S. demand for Luan, a sacred forest. Most of the logging in Indonesia has been authorized by the government, which owns all of the land in the country and gives concessions to companies, sometimes taking land away from individuals. While Indonesia has made a lot of progress in reducing deforestation, officials say they rely on cash crops to build the nation's economy. Satellite imagery revealed the speed and scale of the deforestation in recent years. Maiwana's logging also upended a community 80 miles north of Sungai Mata-Mata village. Sabar Bubu is home to about 100 subsistence farmers on the western edge of Indonesia, Borneo. One morning last year, Andreas Ratias, the leader of the community and a Dayak indigenous man, was harvesting leaves to feed his pigs. Above him, the soaring canopy formed a lattice of overlapping greens that filtered the sunlight. Bird calls echoed through the treetops. For generations, the hamlet's ethos has been to conserve this hilly forest that it considers sacred, Mr. Ratias said, adding, "Animals could not be disturbed. Large trees could not be cut down." But in 2020, Maiwana crews arrived and razed part of the hill. Some residents of Sabar Bubu and nearby areas said they had been detained by the police for protesting against Maiwana and lost their livelihood because of the deforestation. Maria Edo had planted rubber trees over a decade on a 50-acre plot of land in the area. "It was all flattened," she said in tears. She now has to rely on odd jobs to make a living, she said, and sometimes earns nothing. The Meranti timber from Maiwana's deforestation in 2023 ended up in the RV industry supply chain, according to shipping records obtained by EarthSight, from Indonesia to Indiana. For years, the Jayco J Flight has been the best-selling travel trailer in the United States, made by a subsidiary of Thor. Jayco's website states that the J Flight uses Luan. One of Jayco's key suppliers of Luan has been the MJB Wood, a company based in Bristol, Indiana. Over the past 2 years, MJB Wood bought tens of thousands of feet of deforested plywood from Indonesia, including from a supplier that sells tropical hardwood from rainforests, the conservation group said, citing shipping records. MJB Wood did not respond to a request for comment. The Indonesian supplier could not be reached. Thor said it does not have knowledge of wood being supplied to Jayco as a result of deforestation. In Sabar Bubu, Mr. Ratias, the chief, said that he remained worried about the future of the forest. Although the government ordered Maiwana to stop logging last year, he pointed out that the company's permits had not been revoked. He said he wasn't familiar with RVs, which were described to him as vehicles in which people can sleep, cook, and relax. After seeing a picture of one, he laughed and shook his head. Electricity. No problem for native homes now tapping the sun, by Kara Buckley and Ramsey DeGive, from the New York Times. Until mid-June, Graham Bale was living off the usual hodgepodge of makeshift power options used by many people in the Navajo Nation who don't have electricity. In the winter, he used a propane gas heater and a wood stove to heat his decades-old mobile home and small portable solar panels to charge his phone and run some lights. In the summer, when the temperatures reached the triple digits, he'd run his mini-fridge off the panels for a few hours when the sun was brightest and plug in a fan. Mr. Bale, who is 35 and a farmer, lives near Shiprock, in the part of the Navajo Nation that covers northwestern New Mexico. In the Navajo Nation, which stretches into parts of Arizona and Utah, and also wraps around the Hopi Reservation, an estimated 14,000 of households are without electricity, often relying on kerosene lanterns, extension cords hooked up to car batteries, and ice chests. For Mr. Bale, life took a turn in June with the arrival of photovoltaic solar panels, which were provided and installed by Native Renewables, a 10-year-old nonprofit group. It connects Native, Navajo, and Hopi households to reliable solar energy while also generating jobs on tribal land. The panels have battery storage, and Mr. Bale's panels sit on a standalone pedestal outside his wood-paneled mobile home, which he shares with two dogs and three cats. In the days since the new panels went in, as daytime temperatures soared, Mr. Bale has enjoyed modern conveniences that were once out of reach. His mini fridge stays on, cooling drinks and even making ice. He previously had to be extremely cautious about using the precious power at night, but now can work on his computer later, running his online business selling teas, produce, and the seeds of indigenous plants. He even has a portable air conditioner, a swamp cooler, which offers respite from the searing heat. "That has been very, very helpful," Mr. Bale said. "Normally, I'd have to go to family members' homes when it gets too hot. I've been able to spend the majority of my summer here." As many as 1 in 5 households in Navajo Nation and the Hopi Reservation are not connected to the power grid. Those who do have electricity often pay rates that are far more than national average. Plans to expand solar energy projects into underserved communities were thrown into question after the Trump administration froze $7 billion in funds allocated by Congress. But the Environmental Protection Agency has since released the funds, including $500 million set aside for tribal projects. While Native Renewables has received some federal funding, it runs largely on donations and philanthropic grants. Founded in 2015 by two indigenous women, the group has grown from 2 employees to 20, nearly all of them indigenous, including skilled technicians who graduated from the group's workforce training program. The nonprofit has provided solar panels to 119 homes free of charge. Each system, including labor, installation, and 5 years of maintenance, is valued at $27,000 to $30,000. "Some families that we have supported thought they would never have electricity in their lifetime," says Suzanne Singer, the organization's executive director and co-founder. "It's been really incredible to hear how excited they are when it happens. Because many of the homes are in isolated areas without cell service, planning solar installation can be a feat. People live in very remote areas, spending one day a week to hike somewhere where they have reception," Ms. Singer said. "Our team members will try to reach them when they are herding sheep." The photovoltaic panels installed by Native Renewables can supply a maximum of 2,200 watt-hours each day, and the group works with families to calculate what kind of devices or appliances they can use and for how long. "It's kind of like a puzzle," said Chelsea Chi, the organization's deputy director. "If people stay within their daily energy budget, the battery provides enough energy for 3 full days without the sun." Ms. Singer said the families with the new systems report being able to finally host holiday dinners because they have lights and can keep food in the fridge without worrying about running out of fuel. Farmers tell her that for the first time they can freeze their harvest and save food for leaner months. One child was excited to be able to watch a movie all the way through without the diesel generator running out, she said. "Being able to see some of these things happen, or the family's eyes get really big and excited because they've never seen a light turn on in their home, is the best part of the job," Singer said. You've been listening to Native Sun, a show for Indigenous issues on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Your reader is Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Land Back by Hallucination.